couple years ago, I was at the Hopkins State Fair, which I always tell myself I'm going to take a couple years off, and I never do. I always end up going back because I seem to enjoy it a great deal. And I was there one day, and as Bonnie and I were walking by, I walked by this particular display. Now, in case people are looking really closely, that is from a different fair. So he's like, he's lying. No, it is from a different fair, but it is the same display, okay? And so it is, it's a cool-looking Camaro. And he talks about, you know, Big B, transforming robot car. Now, what is that kind of alluding to? Who knows? Transformer movies, right? But clearly they didn't license it, right? Because it's kind of like the Transformer movies. And the thing is that what the display is that they say that it transforms from a car into a robot, because that's what the Transformers do, right? That they're these various vehicles that do vehicle things, but when the time is necessary, they transform into a robot and do robot things. And when they get done doing the robot things, what do? Transform back into a vehicle. So that caught my attention. So I decided to come back and watch the show. And this is a very, very short, just 20-second version of the show, right? So basically, it looks like a car. You know, it looks like a Camaro. And then, is it not running? Why is it not running? Could you hit the space bar for me, Frank? Yeah. There you go. So that basically it does its thing, right? That it kind of goes up, stands up, looks kind of like a robot. But you'll notice as you look at the car parts of it, do you see an engine anywhere? Or a seat anywhere? Or a steering wheel anywhere? But then finally it does stand up and it looks like a robot. If you stand there long enough, it'll spin from one direction to the other. But after all that, it will then, can you hit the space bar for me? All right, terrible tech day. It goes back to looking like a car. I figured you could kind of imagine what collapsing back to a car would look like. So here's my question for you. Now that's a pretty good looking car. You know, much of my life I would have loved to have had a Camaro. But would you buy this as your family car? Well, why not? It doesn't do car things, right? It looks like a car. But it doesn't do car things, right? If you get in a car, there are things you expect it to do, right? You should be able to go to the grocery store, right? You should be able to drop the kids off at school, you should be able to drive to church, you should be able to drive on vacation. You know, even if it was a race car, you would expect it to go really fast around a track. I'm pretty sure they tow this into place. There is a video of it out there somewhere driving in a straight line at like 1 mile an hour. So apparently there is some kind of motor behind it. Now, again, be really clear, it was a cool project, but it's not a vehicle because it doesn't do vehicle things. So as we continue our series that we started off last week, Frank, I'm just going to have to kind of point to you because my remote's just not working. As we started last week, we started the series Christianity Step by Step. And remember what we were talking about in this is that, you know, there's a lot of people out there with their own view and version of what it means to be a Christian. You know, in fact, it's interesting that one of the fastest growing segment of religious people are people who use religious titles, pursue political issues, and never attend church. But that is actually the fastest growing segment in the United States of religious identity. Now, so I guess the question is that how do we know what's true? How do we know what's real? The question I ask is that, what does it look like? I know what a car is supposed to do. So if something that looks like a car doesn't do it, it's not really a car. It's just a facade. Well, if we claim to be Jesus followers, what does it look like? How do we know? And so as we've gone through the series, as we kicked off last week, we started looking at this issue, and we were looking at James, right, the brother of Jesus. And I find James to be one of the more interesting New Testament personalities. As we talked about last week, that James is Jesus' brother, yet he did not believe in Jesus throughout Jesus' life. It wasn't until Jesus' death and resurrection that he started to believe. But then he became a very influential church leader. And what we have to remember is that, you know, people often talk about the good old days. Was it Billy Joel? The good old days weren't always good. sort of thing, that the church has always had struggles. Going back to the very, very beginning, the church has had struggles. Right? We looked at last week. What was the issue that James and other Peter and Paul were dealing with? People saying that this idea of salvation by grace, the idea that putting your faith in Jesus would lead to salvation, there were people saying that's not enough. There were people saying that you also had to do works. In other words, there are things you had to do in addition to that. Yeah, faith is important, but there are things you have to do. If you don't do those things, you're not really a Jesus follower, right? You're not really a Christian. You're not really someone who receives salvation. And do you remember how James addressed that? Right, James said, it's my judgment that we shouldn't make it difficult for these Gentiles who are turning to God. Now, who are Gentiles? All of us. Anyone's not born Jewish. And so basically, James is saying that you guys are layering a bunch of stuff on that's simply not the truth. This idea of having to work your way into salvation is simply not true. And that's what he was kind of focused on last week. Now, this week, I want to start looking specifically at the letter that James wrote. Because remember, that quote actually comes from a church meeting documented in the book of Acts. But the thing that James wrote, how do you think, what's it called, you think? Book of James, there we go, right? The book of James. But what is the book of James actually? It's a letter. It's what most of the New Testament is, right? They're letters. And so what we call the book of James is a letter that James wrote basically to a broad set of churches. And what he was trying to do was address Christianity in a practical way. And what's interesting is that the book of James, we believe, is one of the oldest of the New Testament documents. That the book of James was probably written between the year 45 and 50. Some sources put it back as far as the year 40, but most put it between 45 and 50. Now, for context, if Jesus' crucifixion is between 30 and 35, that means it's written between 10 and at most 20 years from the time of Jesus. And just as we talked about last week, right, this is a period of time where many people are still alive who saw Jesus, knew Jesus, saw the crucifixion, saw Jesus resurrected. But what's happening is, again, as the church begins to spread out and grow, churches are kind of on their own much more. And one of the things that was commonly happening is there were people traveling along, claiming to be, you know, preachers of the gospel, and were teaching things that weren't sound, that weren't solid. And that's what we looked at last week. And there's another issue that comes up that causes James to say something that seems very confusing, particularly considering what we looked at last week. Because something that's quoted from the book of James, in fact, to my knowledge, it's the most commonly quoted aspect of the book of James. And when I hear this quote, it usually sounds like this. Faith without works is dead. Now that's the same guy who said last week, you know, very distinctly, works are not necessary. It is faith alone that does this. So what's he talking about? Is he like, you know, is he kind of making things up as he goes along? Well, notice notice what it says at the bottom. Paraphrase. That's not what he said. He said something that's kind of similar to that, but actually distinct. He says, faith by itself, if not accompanied by action, is dead. So what's going on there? Now, to be clear, he's continuing to stand by that there is no way to work your way to salvation. That is, it is a gift of God. It's received by faith. You can't earn it. It's just given to you by faith. But he's saying that, yes, salvation comes by faith, and you can't work your way to it. But if you put your faith in Jesus, and you actually truly surrender yourself to Jesus, there will be evidence. Right? Just like a car is only a car if it does car things. Doesn't matter what it looks like. A Jesus follower, someone who's truly surrendered their life to Jesus, there should be evidence. There should be things that we do that are consistent with that. Now, that kind of seems obvious. So why does James have to say it? Well, because there were teachers going around claiming to preach the gospel, And there are people saying that, you know what? If salvation is by grace, if it's by faith alone, as long as someone makes an outward expression of faith, doesn't matter what else they do. Doesn't matter. And actually, I grew up around a number of Christians who would actually try to convince people, even try to trick people in the saying what they call the sinner's prayer. Because it's a belief that as people said these magic words that, Lord, I surrender myself to you. Jesus, I want you to be my Savior, and I repent from my sins. And they're like, if they just say that, they're saved. Well, that would be a magic incantation. Right? That doesn't make any sense at all. But this was a common thing that was being said in the first century. And James is like, man, no, that's not it. It needs to be authentic. And if it's authentic, it has evidence. It changes you in some way. You begin to evolve and kind of grow in your faith. There's something, there's a very churchy word called sanctification. What is sanctification? The process of becoming more like Jesus. It's not that you just suddenly change to be like Jesus. That'd be kind of cool, but it doesn't happen. Right? We still make tons of mistakes. Of course we do, and God understands that. But we should be in a process of growing, of learning from it, and getting to be more like Jesus. And the evidence of our faith is that. Now, it's interesting that as James says this, this isn't his opinion. He's actually talking about something that Jesus talked about in one of his most famous sermons, we call the Sermon on the Mount, where he actually kind of stands on a hilltop preaching to thousands of people. And if you read through the Sermon on the Mount, basically, Jesus kind of covers the entire gospel, kind of in this one sermon. In fact, it's kind of interesting that if you look at the book of James, much of what James talks about in this letter that he wrote is really just kind of examples or reinforcement of the sort of things Jesus was talking about in the Sermon on the Mount. So on this issue of, hey, there should be evidence, if you really put your faith in Jesus, there should be some kind of evidence, Jesus says it this way. Jesus says, watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. Jesus says right from the very beginning, there are going to be people who come along and claim they speak for me, and they're lying to you. They're not telling you the truth of the gospel. So you want to be on watch for that. So if we're going to be on watch for it, how do we know? Well, Jesus says, by their fruit, you will recognize them. So, what he's saying is that by their actions, by their behavior, that'll tell you something about them. And then he gives an example. He says, every good tree bears good fruit. Every bad tree bears bad fruit. Right? So if you were to walk up to a tree outside, how would you know, assuming it's growing season, whether it is an apple tree or a pear tree? How would you know? Oh, come on, that's a gimme. By the fruit, right? If there's pears growing on it, would you go, oh, what a great apple tree? Right? Well, Jesus is saying, hey, look at this person. This person comes along saying he speaks for me. Look at what's going on in his life. And that's what James means when he makes the point, faith by itself is not accompanied by action, is dead. When people come along claiming that they speak the gospel and they preach the gospel, look at what's going on in their lives. Are their actions consistent with what Jesus taught? Because if it's not, don't listen to them. And this was a huge issue in the first century, and it's a huge issue now. I mean, I can't comb YouTube for 5 minutes without somebody telling me what I need to do in the name of God, which usually involves sending them money often, right? But because there's false, we use the terms false prophets, false teachers. The bottom line is, people have used religion to manipulate people for centuries. And Jesus says, keep your eyes open for that. Because you will identify them by the way they behave. So if their language is a language of hate, of conquering, of repression, that's not of the gospel. If their behavior is anchored in anger, if their behavior lacks love and justice, that's not of God. And so, to be clear, as Jesus talks about what he's saying and what James says, he's not saying, again, he is not saying that it is our responsibility to judge other people's salvation. Right? We absolutely should not be doing that. Right? That's between a person and God. But what he is saying is use discernment. In other words, use your judgment. If someone comes along speaking the word of God or what they say is the word of God, make sure you're listening to somebody who you should be listening to. Because there's a lot of people out there talking that we should not be listening to. Now, it's not that people need to be perfect, right? None of us are perfect, right? This will shock you, but I get things wrong from time to time. What time is it? 10:30? I've gotten 50 wrong already, sort of thing, right? You know, that we all are on a path of growth. But if someone consistently behaves in a way that's inconsistent with the gospel, the truth of the gospel, you want to really be cautious with them in matters of faith. If their behavior is inconsistent, you want to really be cautious. And if somebody's teaching anything that is not consistent with the gospel, stop listening to that person. You can't go to one of the four gospels and back up that point. Even if it's not the specific point, you can't actually get the foundations of what that person is saying. Stop listening to them because they're not giving you a real picture. Now, as James kind of describes all this, you know, again, he's not saying we should judge other people's faith. He's saying that we should be very careful about who we listen to. But he also wants us to think about our own journeys of faith and what that looks like. And what he's really saying is that, you know, in a kind to yourself sort of way, not in a repressive self sort of way, just look at yourself and say, well, what do my actions say about the state of my faith? Not that you're trying to doubt your faith. You do not want to run through your life doubting your faith. It'll drive you crazy. Right? If you've honestly put your faith in Jesus, trust that. Trust your salvation. But we want to be on a path of sanctification. We want to grow more and more like Jesus all the time. And so he's saying that we should start to look at ourselves too, just to make sure that we're growing in a healthy way. And so he says, what good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? And again, it sounds like he's kind of talking about this works thing tying to our faith. But again, it's the evidence, not what leads to salvation. Because he says that if we look at our lives and we are not incorporating meaningful action in our lives, we want to revisit that and revisit our choices and look at why we're making the choices that we are. Because he then gives us a concrete example. He says, imagine this. I want to give you an example. He says, imagine this. If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, so you come across someone who does not have the clothes they need to stay warm, does not have the food they need to eat, and you actually have the ability to do something about it. You have an extra sweatshirt that you could give them. You've got some food that you could give them. He then says, and then one of you says to them, go in peace, be warm and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body. What good is that? So you know they don't have what they need. And you wish them well anyway. Hey, go be warmed and be filled. How meaningful is your expression of sympathy in that case? It's meaningless. Right? You know they can't do what you're wishing for them. You have the things it takes to help them. You choose not to do that. And then you say, oh, go off, be warm. Be well. He's like, that doesn't make sense, right? It's an empty sympathy. You're saying words to make it look like you care, but clearly you don't actually care. You're just saying it because you think someone wants you to, or you just kind of want the benefit of having said it, but you don't really mean it. He's saying the same thing about when we don't honestly express our faith in Jesus, when we actually just kind of say the words, say we're good to go, and we have no interest in changing, no interest in doing anything different. He says this, so also faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. He's saying just like that expression of sympathy that was not backed by action was an empty expression, an expression of faith that does not lead to us living a life that's more Jesus-centric, more in the way that Jesus calls us to live, then we want to look at that. And we want to think about why we're doing that differently. And again, his goal here is not to make us feel bad about ourselves. I mean, one of the things about James is that he does speak very directly. And I want to clear, this is my opinion. My opinion is that he does that because he doesn't want to bury things in too many words. He wants you to say it really straightforward, that like these are the issues. Like people are kind of using lots of fancy words to trip you up. So I'm just going to say it directly, that these are the things to keep in mind. But so then, if we put our faith in Jesus and we're not sure what to do, like, how do we know what to do? Like, how do we know how to kind of pursue our lives in a way that we are growing closer to Jesus, that we are growing, becoming more, you know, Christ-like? James says that what's not a mystery. He says this: Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. He's saying that if you want to know what to do when you go to church and the preacher preaches from the Bible and God moves on your heart about something you heard, do that. When you're at home and in your personal time, you take a few minutes to read the Bible that day, particularly when you're reading the Gospels, and God moves on your heart about something you should do, do that. James is saying that if you want to know what the process is like, how do we live out our faith in our lives? Listen and do. When you hear the word, do what it says. In fact, he's saying that it should actually motivate us to action. That if we've put our faith in Jesus and we're serious about trying to live a life closer to Jesus, it should motivate us to action. He says, anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like someone who looks at his face in a mirror and after looking at himself goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. Now what is he talking? You know, for years I didn't know what he was talking about, right? Even though I say this is such a practical thing, and eventually I came to understand it. What James is saying, like, is this. Imagine you wake up in the morning and you walk into your bathroom, and you look in the mirror, and you see you got a really bad case of bedhead, you know, and you got all that crusty stuff around your eyes, and you didn't know it, but your nose was running last night, so it's kind of running down the side of your face, all dried and crusty, and you get that kind of white stuff in the corner of your mouth, and you walk out and go to work. He's like, well, you wouldn't do that. That would be ridiculous. Well, he says, well, you know what you need to do. Why? Because the mirror showed you what you need to do. You wouldn't, once it shows you, you would go do it. We're saying the same thing works when it comes to interacting with our Bibles, particularly the Gospels. When you hear something from it, or when you read something from it, and you reflect on it, get the tie-in, mirror, reflect, right? As you reflect on it, you will start to see that it's leading you to make some change. Maybe there's some hostile or unhealthy habit that you're just kind of hanging on to. Maybe there's someone in your life that you treat poorly. Maybe there's just something going on that you know is not good for you or is hurting someone else in your life. As that moves on you, don't be like the person who looked in the mirror and just walked out the door. Do what it shows you. That's sanctification. Sanctification is not moralism, right? It's not about trying to be the most moral person out there and just kind of follow a bunch of rules. It's about transformation. Right? As I say often, right? Jesus tells us that sin is anything that we do that hurts ourselves or someone else. You know, and as we think about that, there are overt actions that have harmed people. But Jesus tells us that when we carry harmful thoughts towards a person, that there's actually something going on there. But when you have this kind of anger towards someone, or you hate someone, you know, you think poorly of someone, you talk bad about someone behind their back, he says all those things are harmful. So when you hear something in church, or when you're reading and you read something, and it brings that idea to mind, I think that you kind of knew you wanted to stop doing anyway, you kind of think you should stop doing. Choosing to not address that is like looking in the mirror, seeing what's there, and walking out without doing anything about it. And one of the things that James wants to make really clear, that as he talks about this idea of looking at what a life of faith calls us to, and when we read things and we hear things, what we should act on, he wants to be really clear what a gospel-oriented life looks like. That he wants us to know that there are things that are consistent with that, and there are things that are not consistent with that. Because again, remember that he's dealing with this issue of inaccurate teachers kind of going through the land. So first of all, he says that, well, let me give you an example of some things that you shouldn't do. He says, did I miss one? So one more? Go again? There you go. Thank you. Those who consider themselves religious and yet do not keep a tight rein on their tongues deceive themselves. And their religion is worthless. That's not me saying that. What does he say? How you talk, how I talk matters. Right? If we think that God is moving us to point out other people's faults, to talk down about people, talk down to people, we're missing it. If we think that God is calling us to be filled with angry outbursts and screaming at people about things, he says you're missing it. Right? And I think that that's the one that we've got to watch most in the time we live in. Right? I feel like we walk around with our anger like a mousetrap. Like we've pulled that arm down, it springs creaking, we put this hair trigger in place, and one little vibration, and we're all flipping out and screaming. Right? People actually make lots of money doing that on TV, I understand. Right? But he says, you know, overt expressions of anger and fury, that's not what God calls us to do. He says, if that's your view of your religion, in other words, your relationship with God, James says, that religion is worthless. He says, I want to tell you what a Jesus-based religion is like. He says, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this. To look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. Now, he talks about orphans and widows. Now, he is specifically saying to the people of his time, you know, orphans and widows, you should take care of them. But he's also talking about, in general, caring for people who need support, for people who need help, right? Because we've talked about this before, right? In the first century, it was a very male-based society, right? A woman would have a very hard time caring for herself if her husband died. A child would have no way to care for themselves if their father died. So when James says orphans and widows, he's saying, look around. Who are the hurting in your community? Who are the helpless? Who are the marginalized? Who are the ones who need support that they're not getting? He says, you want to know what God considers a valid religion, pure and faultless? It's caring for those people. See, the thing is that there somehow has become this model out there that somehow anger is masculine and care is feminine. And I don't get it. Because Jesus fought most for those who were hurting. He tells us to care for people who are hurting. James is reinforcing that, saying that, you know, what's pure and faultless in God's eyes is caring for those who are hurting. So, you know, if you want to fight for something, fight for people who are hurting. Fight for people who are lacking. Fight for people who are in need. Right? That, you know, work to help hurting people, hungry people, homeless people. There's plenty to fight for. We don't have to fight with one another. We don't have to fight with people over political stuff. There are real issues that need help, that need the energy to make a difference in it. James tells us that that's what God sees as pure and faultless. And so as I wrap up, what I want us to see is that oftentimes we have this sense or this idea that the gift of salvation, when we put our faith in Jesus, we get this idea that the gift of salvation is we have to spend eternity with God when we die. Now, we do get to spend eternity with God. But we don't have to wait until we die. Right? The invitation that goes with putting our faith in Jesus is to recognize that our eternal relationship with God starts at that moment. And that God is calling us to grow more and more like Jesus. Because here's the thing, is that a big part of growing to be like Jesus is that in order to be, if you're going to spend eternity with God, you probably want to kind of be thinking kind of like God does, right? You want to kind of be treating people like God does. You want to, and we know that Jesus says this is what God is like. So as we look to eternity, what we're doing is we're growing into eternity when we start to live as Jesus. That this idea of sanctification, of looking at our faith and becoming more and more like Jesus, is all part of growing in our eternal relationship with God. So what this all comes down to is basically that we're called to do the same sort of thing Jesus called his disciples to do. Do you know why? Because we are disciples. If you put your faith in Jesus, you are a disciple. Right? The Gospels show us the interactions he had with those that were physically present with him, but the call on his disciples has not changed, whether you're in the first century or the 21st century. And so James is saying that if you want to embrace that faith and live out doing the sort of things that Jesus directed his first century disciples to do, because he's calling you to do the same things in the context of our world. And so the last thing I want to say is that it's through action that we demonstrate our faith, but it's actually through action that we grow our faith. And as we grow our faith and we carry that faith into the lives around us and we serve the people around us, we become the presence of Jesus around us. And that's ultimately, as his followers, what we're called to do.